Hey guys, welcome to Overcrest. I'm Chris.
And I'm Jake.
And we've got a transformative episode for you guys today. Like truly, truly, truly transformative. This is the old school sound, dude, from like the cartoon. Back
oh,
in
you're
the day.
Right. Yeah, that's is not like, the modern.
No, okay. No, it's I not like the that. Modern one, okay. which I like. I like the like just
the vintage.
I remember when I saw the very first Transformers in the theater. When it did in the movie theater, I got goosebumps. Because I, as a little kid, I played with Transformers, man.
Yeah, I played with them, like, but I never watched any of the cartoons.
Oh, I watched
cartoons.
Watched the cartoon where Optimus Prime dies, and as a little boy, you're just like, and it's just like devastating. Like it was super devastating. Anyway, so we've got Brett Smurz on. I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, and I gave him the opportunity to pronounce his name, but he didn't tell me. You'll see you later.
So,
on wait,
so you so that's on him now. You're
I'm gonna blame him. Yeah, if I pronounce it wrong, it's all his fault. He drove the 3.8 RS. Which we obviously, there's no way in hell they drove a real 3.8 IRS in the movie.
They did not, no, but.
Sounds like they had some carbureted 911, some fuel injected 911. They had a C2. But I'm going to show you, this is the trailer that focuses on the 911 that was released by Porsche. Because obviously this is a partnership. What do you think they did? Do you think,
what?
How does this work? Did, were there rumors that there was going to be another Transformers movie, and some guy at Porsche was like, me, pick me. And then
yeah,
they just
know.
Or was it like, because I'm sure like Dodge was in there going, no, pick me. And
you don't want to be a Decepticon. You know, they could put you as a Decepticon, and that'd be bad news.
You think so?
Well,
because the police cars were Decepticons, remember from the previous movie.
Yeah.
Those were Dodge, I believe.
Yeah,
I believe those were Dodge. Or no, was it like a Mustang police car? I think it might have been.
You're right.
Yeah. Which you don't really see that very often. But there's got to be like, obviously, this is so ingrained in it.
For sure.
There's obviously a partnership going on. So I'm going to play the trailer and then we'll talk to Brett.
Was all a dream.
Woo! The name's Mirage.
Come on.
Kill Tap.
I'm blowing up like you thought I would. Call the trip, same number, same but it's all good.
Hard. I'm not driving.
Nah.
Relax.
I'm Mirage.
What's funny is he says, I'm not driving. And then in my head I go, yeah, you're not. Brett is.
And if you don't know, now you know.
All right. There it is. Let's get back to reality here.
All right. So it's supposed to be a Carrera RS.
A 3.8 RS.
964,
Which we now know it's a C2 or a 930 or something that needed
jetting.
Yeah,
there was a few
some carburetor.
Six, I think, five or six.
They're not going to jump a million-dollar car.
No,
off of
a... and I just looked it up here because we were talking about, you know, product placement or how it actually came together as a partnership. Apparently, there is a person who's in charge of representing Porsche Cars North America in entertainment and product placement.
Okay. Well,
it's a whole thing. Yeah, a whole firm. Yeah, there is only 55 of the Carrera RS 3.8s were made as homologation cars.
Yeah, so they're not jumping those off.
They're
anything.
Worth a million and a half ish.
Yeah.
So,
Brett's been in some movies that you might know. Ford versus Ferrari. You know that?
Oh, wow.
That one. Six Underground.
That
was a good
that
movie.
That was awesome.
Transformers Rise of the Beast, obviously. He's done a lot of other stuff like Fear of the Walking Dead, Ghostbusters, Suicide Squad, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. That was a TV series.
Yep.
There's too many to read here. He's really got a great resume. Audi,
that's
Think
awesome.
Faster. Oh, should have asked him about that. I didn't see that till just now. Yeah, so he's been in just an absolute ton of stuff. American Sniper. I mean,
that's really cool.
Legit. Mission Impossible, Ghost Protocol. I mean, it's just like all kinds of cool.
Oh, yeah. He did mention that one.
Yeah
we get to hear a little bit about Peek
behind
the curtain,
about all
so it
but
is.
Before we get into our interview with Brett, what have you got for us?
Yeah, let's take a moment to talk about PetrolBox, monthly service made specifically for the automotive enthusiast. Chris, each month, what do we get? We get an awesome box right there on the doorstep.
I don't get anything because my wife and kids terrorize the box.
That's right.
I don't get anything.
Which is, it just goes to show that it is a good gift for just about anyone, especially those that are into cars and car enthusiasts. Detailing supplies, garage gear, tools, apparel, stickers, pins, you name it, collectibles. It comes once a month for as little as $19.95 a month, or you can do the Petrolbox Premium for $39.95 a month. Check them out at mypetrolbox.com. Use the code Overcrest. That'll get you a discount as well.
All right, here's our interview with Brett. Yo, Brett, how's it going, man? Thanks so much for coming on the Overcrest podcast. I appreciate you being here.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. I'm super excited to talk to you guys.
I noticed that your last name has no vowels, so I don't know what to do. Help me.
Yeah, my mom's joke, she always says, Vanna wouldn't let us buy a vowel. So, you know, we're kind of out of luck there. So.
Right on, dude. So it's interesting. I sat down with my kids. And I'm like, they always want to watch a movie. They like watching movies with dad. And I got like big TV and big speakers and stuff. And the subwoofer's hidden behind the couch, same size as the couch, all this stuff. So we always want to watch like an action movie or something, or a Marvel movie. And so I saw all of a sudden the new Transformers movie is available for rent. I'm like, oh, this is going to be great. We're going to watch Transformers. The kids, we've watched all the other ones. They're always a good time. They're never like, I never feel like I'm expecting Scorsese. So it's cool. You know, and they're always just like a good action film that's entertaining. And we sit down, we turn it on, and like, I'm waiting because like the kids love the 9/11, right? They love my 9/11. And the 9/11 pops up on the screen, and it's Mirage. And hold on, I got the sound. Hold on, let me play it. He's like, he's got the sound, and he pops out, and it's the 9/11. And the kids are freaking out, and I go, and by the time I was done watching this movie, I'm like, dude, I bet somebody stunt drove that 9/11. I need to find out who that was. And that is you, man. You are the driver. You did it. That is awesome, dude. I'm really impressed that at some of the work I saw that you did there.
Thank you so much. It was fun. It was a fun project. When I got called for it and he told me what car I was going to be driving, my face like lit up. I was super excited. You don't see it often in movies, so when it was the car that was chosen, I was really, really happy. And I knew I was in for a challenge because, you know, the engine, rear engine and stuff, it was difficult. So
before we get like, I want to talk all about that stuff, but I want to figure out how you got there, you know, because this being able to drive, you seem pretty young, you know, so being able to drive that car in Transformers at your age as a stunt driver, that's a pretty big deal. You're a younger dude. How did you start getting into cars that allowed you to launch into your career so early?
So I raced go-karts when I was young. When I was 12, I got into go-kart racing and did that for some time, and went from there to open wheel and sports cars.
Hold on. Let's go-karting. Okay. I always hear this. So did you, I mean, you wanted to be a race car driver. Like what's inspiring you to do go-karting? Like, is dad like, you are going to go-kart, or are you saying, dad, I really want to get a go-kart? Which one is happening here?
Yeah, it was more like my dad was a racer and he really wanted to, he wanted me to be in racing. So I asked for a dirt bike. And when I asked for the dirt bike, he got me a go-kart for Christmas. Okay. And I went out to the garage and saw this thing and I was like, oh, that's cool. Like, I can't complain about that. So, we started racing the go-karts. It was called a Mari kart. It was a tiny, like, you know, the tiny little, where the wheels are exposed and they're super low to the ground, like this high off the ground.
Yep.
That one went up probably about 60 miles an hour. So it was
pretty
fun. So you
didn't start with the one that has like the, you know, the, when you have a push lawnmower, it's got those little wheels. With
the
little
four strokers. No,
yeah, that wasn't you.
Strokes.
Huh?
My dad just threw me to the wolves. Basically we got, honestly, when I first started racing, he entered me in like the nationals and all this stuff. And just kind of threw me to the wolves. But,
it's in your blood, son. It's in your blood.
Exactly. Exactly.
What did you said your dad was a racer. What was he doing that got you into that?
He actually road raced motorcycles. So he raced, it was called back in the day in the 70s, late 70s. It was Formula One for AMA. So he was racing against like Eddie Lawson and Wayne Rainey and all those guys. And he was very competitive. And so when he was done racing, he got into stunts. And so when I was growing up and I started asking for like dirt bikes and stuff, that's when he decided to get me into that.
So when you like motocross or motorcycle racing, I ride, but I'm not into the racing side of it. So I'm picturing like, is this Isle of Man TT stuff, like that level, or?
Yes, it is, but not on the, like, that's kind of like a street course, you know what I mean? Okay. Like, he was doing it, he was doing it on, like, tracks. Like, he'd be at the old Road Atlanta or Watkins Glen or, you know, so all worldwide, nationwide, I mean, for the motorcycle racing. So
you get this go-kart, and your dad's like, all right, we're doing this. You're going to Nationals. Did you feel pressure as a kid to perform? Like, was this, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, big time. I mean, he really, my dad's a pretty serious guy, and he really wanted, he was being, like, really, you know, pretty strict about everything, and we would go out every weekend. I mean, I literally, when we were getting into it, I was probably racing, I'm not even exaggerating, like 35 plus times a year, like almost every weekend we'd be out racing. So, and it was always somewhere different. We had an RV, we'd travel and go somewhere else, some new series, new competitors, just go everywhere. It was a lot of fun.
Have you paid him back yet?
No, I promised him when I was really little that I was going to buy him a Ferrari Spider someday, which I think is kind of turning into a, it's going to be a problem for me sometimes. So when actually buy it,
maybe a Miata convertible would be.
That sounds better. So.
Probably handles better anyway. So how did you do in karting? You're doing all these big races. Your dad's really pushing you. I mean, were you really dedicated at this? Like, how serious about this were you?
Oh, no, we were very serious. I mean, we were racing the likes of, like, Joseph Newgarden, who I used to race against, Connor Daly, Sage Karam, Gabby Chavez, a bunch of, you know, Carlos Munoz, a bunch of people that made it to the top, Jordan and Ricky Taylor. So the competition was really heavy. So luckily, you know, it was our generation of drivers was pretty fast. And so we were all competing with each other in all these different series. And so we were all pushing each other, but it was very serious. I mean, these guys were spending, $250,000 a year in go-karting. I mean, this is like top level stuff. And the series I was racing was called Stars of Karting. And it was sanctioned by the Indy Racing League. So they basically were trying to make like a ladder system from go-karting all the way up. And that's when I was racing.
It wasn't you and like Ryan Gosling or something, right? Like
exactly. Exactly. So I was trying to work my way up the ladder. I really wanted to race IndyCar. That was my goal. And so I was really trying. That's why I got into open wheel and did some Formula 4s. And
what was it about IndyCar that was your thing?
So I always wanted to do Formula 1, but there's not really any American drivers, and the ones that do kind of make it there don't really, in my opinion, they're not given like a fair chance, like a good opportunity to showcase themselves. Like, for instance, Alexander Rossi went and drove, and he was in the Lotus car and all that, but you know, he's like 9 seconds off the pace, and it just makes you wonder. It's like, why is he so far off the pace? And then he races Indy, and he's one of the top drivers. And you know, some Formula One drivers come from F1 and go to Indy and they're just the same speed. So it's kind of interesting when you think about it, like why, you know, they need to be given better opportunities to showcase themselves, especially now that, like, talking about going to Vegas and Miami and bringing races to America. So let's bring some Americans back into F1.
If you're going to start dragging people out of the NASCAR seats, which I think NASCAR has been on a downswing, not huge, but like 20 years, hasn't been doing super great. If you're trying to steal those people, and you want people to sit down and drink like a Coors Light in front of their TV and watch something, it isn't going to be somebody named Maximilian Verstappen. Okay, they're not. They don't like. Just dude, if you would have made Formula One, that's who you'd be racing against right now. So it's probably maybe good that you didn't.
Yeah, for sure. No, it's
from what I see anyway.
So I like IndyCar because honestly, the IndyCars are just as fast. Actually, they're, you know, sometimes faster on the ovals than the F1s and. They started leaning more towards, you know, road course racing as I was getting into it. So I love that. That's my bread and butter. I wasn't really a fan of ovals, so I was really happy they were leaning towards the road courses. But yeah, so that was really my goal, was to be an IndyCar driver. And then when I turned 18,
karting from 12 to 18. 12 to 18 karting? So that's a long
12,
time, man.
12 to 16 for karts, and then 16 to 18 was I raced MX-5 Miatas, and I raced the Jim Russell and Skip Barber racing series and a couple Formula Ford races.
What are you driving? When you're 15, 16 years old and you're going to drive Mazdas at the racetrack, what are you driving to the racetrack at this time? Like, what is your car life like?
When I was 15, I was driving my mom's Honda CRV.
There you go. Was it automatic and everything?
It was automatic, and it was my first experience driving in the snow. So that was, I was, you know, constantly sliding that thing around and having fun with that. But yeah, no, that was my first get up with going to the track. I was always honestly just riding with my dad in the RV, or, you know, just kind of getting toted there. So
I see that you've got E30 M3 in the background. At some point, streetcars must have become something important to you.
Yeah, I honestly collect old BMWs. I'm actually selling a couple right now, so I'm trying to kind of, you know, clear out the stable a little bit. But I have a few. I have my E30 M3. I have an E36 M3. I have a E34 M5 wagon, and I have an E34 M5 sedan. So that's what I have.
Why BMW?
Well, so to be honest, my buddy, when I was 16 years old, I just got my driver's license. I went to go visit him in Washington, and he owned an E30 M3 that he bought for 15 grand at the time, which was a steal. And it was in really good shape because the motor blew up within 100 miles of him driving it. So he had to replace it. But I got to borrow that car for a week and drive it around Seattle for a whole week, just cruising around. And I fell in love with that car, and that's when I was like fully BMW from that point on.
All right. So you did the BMW thing, you're racing Mazda MX-5s, you're getting close to, how close are you getting into IndyCar when you're thinking about it? Like, are you right there? Are you at the cusp? What's going on in your life?
I was all the way to the cusp of the guy who doesn't have a lot of money to spend, but I'm knocking on the door, you know? So all the teams knew who I was, but I didn't have like sponsorship funding and things like that. So I basically, my dad was paying for my career until I was 18, and I had a few product sponsorship basically. And then as soon as I turned 18, my dad, you know, kind of dropped me and said, hey, look, if you want to continue this, you got to find sponsors. You got to start doing this because it's getting really expensive. So I was ready to go into Star Mazda and race Star Mazda, which was the first feeder into IndyCar. And that alone was, I got an offer from a team for 380 grand, which was the top team. And that was cheap. I mean, it was to win in that series, you've got to spend like $500,000. So
they wanted you to buy in at 380 grand. They didn't want to give you three.
Yeah, like, no, they wanted me to pay them 380 grand to race, which their typical price was probably 500 plus. But it was actually, he's now an IndyCar owner. It was Junkos Racing is who offered that to me. And that was right after I raced the Formula Ford Festival at Brands Hatch. And I was having a really rough weekend. And I was in the last chance qualifier in last place. And you have to finish top three. And the race is three laps long. And Brands Hatch is pretty difficult to pass on. So I was like, you know, pretty bummed out. I didn't think I was going to make it. But I did. I finished in, you know, third place and got through. And then on the main event, I went from 27th and I finished third for the race. So
so is that 380 grand being a discount from 500? Is that a reflection of you being pretty good? They're like, hey,
that's,
man,
why. That's what I was leaning into. He was actually there watching, and he watched me race this race and pilot come through the pack and do really well. And that's a pretty notorious race. And it was probably my best, you know, result of my career. And he was there watching, and as he walked up to me and he offered it to me like right then and there. So I wish that I had the money to spend on that, but I didn't. So
it seems like a chicken and the egg kind of thing. Like, you don't have the money until you have the big partnerships, but you can't be right. The big partnerships until you have the money. So what did you do? You're just like, sorry, bro, I'm broke. Or like, how does this, where's this?
Yeah. So I had a plan. We had a plan, and it ended up not working out because I was racing Jim Russell Racing Series, and they had brand new Formula 3 Lotus cars that they imported from Europe as their school series training cars. And they had a racing series, and I was doing that the last 2 years, and I was winning I won the championship every year. And every year that you win the championship, you get a free season to come back and race again. But when I was doing that race, they were planning on doing a championship prize for the winner of the next year to go to F2 for a free racing season in Formula 2. Like, that was the prize package.
That's
so
insane.
I was like, it was insane. So I was like, that's what I'm going to do. Like, I've won the championship twice in a row. I'm going to do this. So that's what I was going for. I told them no. I put all my eggs in the basket for Jim Russell, and then they went bankrupt, like, right before the series.
No. Probably because they were giving away races in Formula 2.
Yes. So that kind of foiled all the plans there. And, it was just one thing kind of led after the next. And it was just my money was getting spent, and I was not going anywhere. And my dad did stunts for a long time, and he kind of showed the door for me in the stunt world. And I just decided to stick with that and just kind of drop racing for a little bit.
Fighter pilots go and they fly for like Delta Airlines. Is this what race car drivers do when they just say, yeah, I can't do $500,000. That's insane. Well, let's go jump this car off a building instead.
That's kind of how it goes. And it's just getting your foot in the door. That's the hard part. So luckily I already had it, and it just worked out.
So one thing that we haven't mentioned yet is that you have a prosthetic leg.
Yes.
And when did in the story of your career and what you've given us, when did this happen? Did it happen after where we're at now, or in the middle, or where are we at?
It was directly in the middle. So basically I won some national championships in go-karting, the Stars of Karting. And I was doing really well in that. I won some scholarships to do some Skip Barber, courses and races. And so I was doing all that, and it was in the middle of that. It was when I was 16 years old. I had done one Formula Ford race, and then I lost my leg. So it was fresh.
What happened? Tell us what happened.
Yeah. So I was actually flying home from an MX5 Cup race. I landed that day from Atlanta at home, and then I went to my girlfriend's house, and we were screwing around on the trampoline, and I saw a balcony next to the trampoline, and I said, "Hey, let's jump off the balcony." Actually, my friend said that, but we.
I thought you were going to tell me you were fooling around with your girlfriend. You broke your leg. I was like, dude, that's pretty rambunctious, man.
No, she didn't even watch. That's the messed up part. So,
I get up on the.
No, she didn't see it. So I get up on the balcony, and I'm standing up there, and my buddy jumps off and lands, and I thought that was cool, and I was like, you know what? I'm going to one up him. I'm going to flip off the balcony. So, it's high. It's like 12 foot high, and onto the trampoline. So I did this front flip with a twist, and I landed on my feet, but I was still twisting. And like when you're jumping on a trampoline, you have to be pretty straight. Like when you land from such a high height, I used to do gymnastics when I was younger. That was my specialty, was trampoline. And that's why I tried what I tried.
I was going to say with a twist, dude, that's pretty.
Yeah, it was pretty brave.
I don't even walk with a twist.
Yeah, so it didn't work out. I broke my tibia plateau fracture on my tibia.
And that's your shin bone, right?
Syndrome. Yeah. It's basically like right here. It just broke straight down here. It jammed up into my kneecap. So my meniscus was jammed, and it pretty much exploded my knee and cut the artery and nerve. And I was bleeding out internally. It's called compartment syndrome. It wasn't punctured. So the blood was staying in. It was just pooling.
Yeah,
and so my leg just kept, swelling up, and that's when I realized that I was in, deep trouble. So I got to the hospital, and
who drove you to the hospital?
Well, I called my mom. So we weren't old enough to drive at this point. Like none of us really had our driver's license yet. So my mom had to drive 30 minutes from the house to pick me up, and then to the hospital. And so it was like 4 hours before I even got into a surgery, and it took them 3 days to figure out that the artery was cut. So, I learned later that you have 6 hours to save a cut artery or it's pretty much toast. So it was long gone after 3 days. They had to take it off, and short story. It was 10 surgeries, in total. I had 9 surgeries in 13 days, lost 50 pounds, almost died from it. So it was pretty hairy.
What was going through your mind, as you're just driving to the hospital? Just like your whole career flashing before your eyes? You're looking at your leg.
When I first flipped off the balcony and broke my leg, the first thing that popped into my brain was, man, I have a race this weekend. I'm gonna have to race with my broken leg. That was the first thing that popped into my head. And I got to tell my dad, he's gonna kill me. That was because he's already paid for the race and everything. So, but no. And then the second thing after my leg went fully numb, like it was like dead, numb. I've never felt anything like you. Usually when something goes numb, it's tingly, like you can still feel it. But this was like dead, like it was not even there. So I found that to be really weird. So in my brain, I actually said to my mom, which was kind of eerie and weird. I said to her on the drive to the hospital, I said, are they going to have to amputate my leg? Like, I can't feel it, which was totally like random. Like, you wouldn't think you would have to do that, but it ended up happening. So
is she freaking out? She's like, don't say that.
She was. I mean, she was like, no, it's just broken. You know, I've had broken leg before and it just, you know, that's just how it feels. And I was like, I don't know. Like, it was pretty numb.
Okay, so you're in the ER for surgery for, you know, 10 surgeries. I mean, what's your state of mind? I mean, as you're going through, that's a long time to lay there by yourself.
Yeah, to be honest, I mean, I was on all kinds of drugs, and I don't really remember a lot of it in between. I do remember like specific parts. I remember the doctor coming in and like squeezing my leg to make sure that it was dead, you know, before they took it off, and he was like looking at me in the eyes, like poking me with a needle. Like, you tell me right now if you can feel this. And so that was a pretty serious moment. And then when they came in to tell us that they were going to amputate it, my mom lost it. So I remember that, but I was like, to be honest with you, it's kind of strange, like a calendar of events, because I just read Alex Zanardi's My Sweetest Victory, the book, like probably a couple months before I broke my leg. And that's where he lost both of his legs in a racing accident and came back and started racing again. And so now I'm dealing with it. And so the first thing that popped into my brain was him and his story. So I said, well, if he can get back racing with both legs gone, then I'm going to be fine. That was one. And two, I have a friend, his name's Casey Puretti. He's a stunt guy. He's also missing his leg, right leg below the knee, but he builds like all kinds of contraptions and stuff. And for instance, like if you watch the movie Wind Talkers, he did a scene where he's running through the exploding field and he's carrying his buddy and it gets blown up and he like blows into the air and his leg gets blown off. So that was like, he builds stuff like that. So I've known him since I was a little kid, and those two things, like in my brain, I just decided, you know, if they can do it, so can I. Like, it's not a big deal. I'll just get back on my feet and keep going. So, or foot.
Someone who doesn't, whatever. Like, I can't understand what this is like. You know, I just can't. And I perceive it as something that would dominate my life. How do you keep your life from being defined by this? Like, just directing you in every way.
You know, it's, I mean, I hate to say like the cliche, it's just one step at a time, but it really, like, it is. Like, you just gotta, you know, everything that's like, if something's difficult, you just have to work around it and figure it out, and then you just, you know, keep on that path. Like, I try and do everything with my leg, you know, non-modified, no modifications, and that takes longer for me to learn sometimes. But I like to do things like normal people. Like, I don't like to have a shifter that's specifically for a bike, you know. I have to, because it's, I can't tilt my foot, but just an example. So like, I try and keep things like rock climbing, I keep my foot the same. They have feet for rock climbing, like little, kind of crazy actually, like they have like little goat hoofs, so it's almost like cheating. Like, they shorten your legs like this long and it's like a goat hoof. Yeah. It would work out pretty well, but no, it's just, you know, you just gotta mentally, I think most things in life are mental, and you just have to put yourself in like a good mental state of mind and not let the negative thoughts empower you and just keep moving forward. That's kind of all I can say.
Was there anybody that helped you? Was there anybody that helped you through things?
That helped me through things? Yeah, for sure. When I first lost it, my physical therapist up in Spokane, Washington, his name's Brad Sharples. He pretty much, you know, saved my life. Like, I mean, to be honest, I hate to say that, but like, he did. Like, I had to relearn how to walk. I had to relearn everything. And he was really just a positive guy. And he put me in a good state of mind. Every single time I went in there, I was in a better state of mind. I wanted to go in there. He was fun. So honestly, that's also really important. I think I got really lucky with the physical therapist, in my opinion. He's probably one of the best in the world, like from physical therapist I've worked with. It's just like, he's almost like a, I'll put it this way. Like, when I used to race go-karts, I had a coach, and he was a mental coach, and he would try and get me in the right mindset. and he would help tune the cart, but his sole job was like to mentally get me prepared. And I would say that he was the same way. Like he would get me in a good state of mind and then work out, you know, the leg and everything. So that makes a big difference too. So that he helped me in, you know, in the beginning. And then after I was able to walk and everything, then it just started getting better and better.
So what, speaking of mindset, what was the first time you got back in the car competitively?
So I actually, it would have been faster, but I had some complications. That 10th surgery I had was actually like a month and a half after the amputation. But that one fixed everything. And that's a long story in itself. But so I got all fixed up. And after that, I was able to get back to racing. So it would have been a month, but 3 months after the amputation, I got back in the car. I couldn't really walk. I had a cane. I basically was using crutches with the leg on to get used to the weight. The hardest part for me was it was an F1600 open wheel, and the clutch is really stiff in those. So putting the pressure to get the clutch pedal pressed was kind of hard because I couldn't even walk. But I really only needed to use it to get out of the pits. And then after that, it was, you know, my leg was kind of a dead weight and I was right foot braking. But to answer your question, I got back into racing 3 months after, and it was at the Formula Ford race, and I ended up doing better, way better than I ever thought I would. I got out of the car for qualifying, and my parents said, you know, so how do you think you did? And I was like, yeah, I was like, I had fun. I was just out there cruising, and they go, well, you just broke the track record. So I was like, I was moving, I guess. I don't know.
Is there something that mentally changed for you that you think allowed you to perform better, or do you think you would have performed that well anyway?
To be honest, I've done it a few times now since I've quit. I haven't quit racing. I'll take these like times off where I'm not in the car for a long time, and then like say a year, 2 years, 3 years, and when I come back, I almost feel like I'm faster. I don't know if it's because I'm just enjoying it. I'm actually having fun. Like I really want to go, and it's not like a job, you know, like for instance, like if I was going to the track every weekend, you know, doing time attack I had an E36 M3 time attack car that I would go and have fun. And when I took 2 years off and came back, the first day I came back, I was like faster than I was. I don't know if it's because I was over driving, trying to beat my times. If I was just becoming a chore, like I was trying to beat times going every weekend and it was just a lot of work, or, you know, I don't really know, but taking that time off, it helped. Like it just made me go slower and everything. I was thinking about things more. And so maybe that's why, because I had such a big break in between and I really missed it. But I think it was more so just trying to have fun. Once you're at that stage, you're not thinking specifically on, you know, going fast. So,
okay. So stunt driving. Tell me about the first stunt driving experience you had. What was your first job? Don't say it's like parallel parking or something. It's got to be good.
Yeah, no. This I have a good one. So this was right when my dad opened the doors for me for the stunts. So he offered it to me when I was 18, right after I finished the Jim Russell series that year. They went bankrupt, and so he offered this to me, and it was a 3-week job on the movie called The Surrogates. And we filmed it. It was reshoots, and we filmed it in Los Angeles. It was a Bruce Willis movie.
Oh, I remember this. Yeah.
I want to say it was 2009.
Mm-hmm. I saw this.
And so he offers this job to me, and I'm basically, he taught me like a few weeks prior to how to build a stunt bag and like build it up. Like, this is what you need. So I built one up. He
is
hires
just
me
like
on
a lot of like Icy Hot or what?
you would think so. No, it was like chains and belts and things you would put in a car, you know, for crashing, like catcher's shin pads, elbow pads, hard elbows, fire suit, things like that.
You get pulled over with that with a girlfriend in the car, you're in deep shit, man.
And they're gonna, yeah, I know. They don't, like, they'll think,
where are you guys going?
You.
Whose basement are you going to?
Absolutely. So he taught me how to build this bag. He gets me on set, and I'm hanging out for like a week and a half and having fun with everyone, doing background driving. And one of the days I show up to set, he points over to this Chevy Avalanche and goes, hey, you know, go get in that truck and get seated, and Russell's going to help you put your belts in. And didn't tell me what I was doing. And I was like, okay. And so I go over there and I put my seat belts in, and I walk back to him. I go, okay, so my belts are in. And he goes, okay, So you're going to get in that truck and you're going to drive into this car in this intersection. You're going to hit it at 40 miles per hour. And yeah, so are you good to go? And I was like, yeah, I'm good. I think, honestly, I think he did it this way because it was, he wanted to see how I would react to doing a big crash, like,
yeah,
right away.
Of it.
Just to see if I was right for the business or not. I think that's really why he did it. Cause like I told you earlier, my dad really likes to like go hard right away. Like he threw me to the wolves with racing and threw me to the wolves with stunts like right away. So, it went really well. I had to do that twice because they blew the glass too early on the car, went right before I hit it. So I had to do that twice.
Wait, what and do you mean? The next... So the glass doesn't just explode when you hit it?
No, it was for cinematic effect. They put like CG or they put squibs in the windows, and there's a guy on a button. So when I go and hit the car, the windows like explode out.
Okay.
Like the window would probably just shatter and break in. They want it to like, you know, they want to see
otherwise
it.
Otherwise, it looks, if it's not timed right, it looks like the Matrix where everything happens like a second later because the Matrix can't react. Got it.
Exactly. Or sometimes they do like rubber glass with air and then they'll like blow it and it like explode and it looks like glass.
I feel so deceived.
So I did that twice. This is where it gets interesting. So the next day I had to do it. It was a blind intersection, the same crash, but now the car is moving and it had a camera on it. And so we were going into the blind intersection and I hit the truck, nailed it, perfect. But this truck was like it was a camera truck, like this big tank, huge. And so it doesn't get damaged when you hit it. And so I hit this thing, and it's a long story behind why my dad was standing right there. But I hit this truck and it spins out right where he's standing, and it hit him, actually.
Oh.
And it blew his kneecap in half. And he got thrown like 30 feet down the road. I didn't know this right when I hit the truck. So I T-bone the truck and I stop and I'm parked there and I get a phone call and there's a phone like ringing and someone starts talking and they're like, hello, sir. Hello. Are you okay? And I personally thought it was like a stunt guy.
This is OnStar.
Yeah. I thought it was a stunt guy screwing with me on the radio. And so I was like, whatever. And And they go, hello, sir, this is OnStar. Are you okay? You've been in an accident.
No way!
And I'm like, what? No, I'm actually like, I'm on a movie set. Like, we just crashed the car. She got all excited and was like, oh my God, okay, all right, I'm sorry. But this is all happening super quick. And I look in my mirror and I see my dad's just like lounging out on the ground. Like, he's laying down in the street. I was like, that's like, what is he doing? Like, so I get out of the car and I walked up and saw his knee and I was like, holy shit. It was pretty bad. I mean, if I showed you the photo of it, it's pretty gnarly, but it was a good one. So that was my
first. He's okay, right? He's okay.
That was
my
first stunt.
Dad's good. Dad's good.
He's doing good.
Okay, good. Just get that out there. So as you've done stunt work, has it been getting more and more complex? You know, instead of just running into somebody is easy. I feel like I could maybe run into somebody. I don't want to because I don't want to wake up, you know, the next morning and take like 76 Advil. But like as things progress, you start rolling cars, you start drifting cars, you start doing more than just crashing. You know, what does it take to become the guy that just crashes the Avalanche into the car to the guy that's, you know, drifting cars through the city?
That's a good question because it's really a big difference. Because there's a lot of guys that can jump in the car and crash, and I mean, there's endless. I could give you tons of people. It's just like when you have to do the lead ups to that and then crash, that's when it becomes really hard to find someone because there's not a lot of good drivers that are willing to crash. Mm. Like, there's a lot of people that are willing to crash, but as far as people that can, you know, slide the car precisely, hit a mark, come through the corner quickly, do some really good maneuvers and then crash, usually they'll call someone different. Like, they'll have two different people, unless it's like specifically they hired someone that does both. A lot of times they'll hire someone different because
is that because like precision
mindset.
Driving is the opposite of crashing? I mean, these guys,
yeah,
have like,
I mean,
like, I don't want to crash. I've spent my whole life trying not to do that.
I'll put it this way. Like, for instance, a lot of the top guys you see that are doing those in the movies and stuff or commercials, like you got Reese Millen, you've got like Sam Heubanet, Tanner Faust, all these guys are huge big time racers. So they don't, A, they don't want to risk, you know, crashing and getting injured. So that's one reason. Two, they don't need to, because they make good money. They get calls all the time to do fun driving stuff and cool stuff. And so they don't need the money to do the crashes. So it would really only be for a cool factor for them to do it. So for the most part, they don't, they just don't do it. So those guys are already out of the equation for, you know, doing a crash. So then it's like, to find someone else, it's, you know, they have to be a good driver, because it's got to be good, you know, good driving scenes. And so it's just really, it's kind of a strange, you know, part of the business. But yeah, there's not a, like a huge list of people for doing like precision, you know, sliding cars and doing that precisely on camera, I guess.
So what are some of the other fun things you've done in terms of sliding around and blowing things up?
Yeah, I worked on Extraction, the first one. That was fun. I did Six Underground. I got to drive the Alfa Romeo for that. That's in the first like 20 minutes of the movie, big chase scene in that. That was a dream job. I got to say, that was probably my favorite of all the jobs I've done.
Why is that? Why did you love that one so much?
Because it was all real. Like everything we did was real. I mean, same with Transformers. We did everything real as well. But in Italy, it just made the big difference. I mean, we were driving through the streets of Florence, Italy, tearing it up. I mean, I don't know how much opportunity I'll get again to do that in my lifetime. So I think it was pretty just special to be there doing it. And not only that, but like I actually drove through some real museums, and like it was to the point. Almost every take, we would do something next to...
Did you say that you drove through real museums?
I drove through a real museum. About the size of this garage, actually. It was tiny. It was tiny. So the room for error was massive. And if I hit anything, it was shutting the show down completely. So, and that was like every day.
The insurance company would have gone bankrupt.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think they basically told us that we could do all these things, but as soon as we start wrecking things, then we're done. And luckily, we didn't wreck anything, so it all worked out.
Is there anybody that you look up to in this industry that has inspired you to be better? Like, who's your guy? Who's your mentor?
I'm in a driving group called Drivers Inc., and there's a lot of really talented people in that group. I look up to a few people in that group. I look up to Mike Johnson. He owns this company called Pursuit Systems. And they basically operate all camera cars. You know, there's a lot of different companies, but they're probably the top camera car company in the film industry. And, so I look up to him. He's a really chill guy. He's smart. He's a very good driver. So I look up to him. Brent Fletcher is another one. He's in our business and just super talented. I watched him do something pretty spectacular once, and that, like, I've always looked up to him from that one.
What is the main thing that these guys that they've given you, what have they imparted upon you, though, if you could pick something?
To be honest, it's mostly like just how to handle yourself on a set. That's really, or how to, like, just small tricks. Like they taught me to really practice the little things, like, you know, like backing up to your number one position, or, you know, don't talk too much on the radio, just listen, and or don't call someone out on the radio, like walk up to them and say stuff like that. It's just like set etiquette is what it's called, and that's really like the most important thing in my opinion. If you want to continue, you know, working, you can't be a goofball, basically, is what I'm getting at.
So, and you probably can't be a fanboy either. Like, oh my God, there's Sylvester Stallone. Hey dude, I love you in Rambo. This is great.
That won't work.
Sign my arm. Yeah. Okay. So I want to maybe transform the conversation a little bit here. No, Jake's shaking his head. He doesn't like it. No, he doesn't like it. Okay. So I imagine, what is a phone call like to be like, hey man, do you want to drive one of the most iconic sports cars of all time in a blockbuster film? Like, how does this happen? Like, does your agent call you? Does Optimus Prime call? Like, how does this work out?
Well, this one was kind of funny because my friend was supposed to do it. He was supposed to drive, but he ended up getting busy for something else. And so he called me.
It better be good,
and...
man. It better be whatever this busy is. It better his mom got married, or
the car commercials are kind of an interesting, you know, side of the business, and you can make good money from doing car commercials. And so he was to be honest with you, he's probably going to make more money doing car commercials than he would have doing that. So he was really looking at the money aspect of things, and I was looking at it, you know, this is going to be rad. So when I got the call, I was stoked. But the way that it works really for us is it's not the agents that call. Like most of us don't have agents. It's mostly word of mouth. So whoever trusts you to do something like that to that extent. And I think that my driving that I did on Six Underground kind of proved myself. And this guy was looking for someone young and someone different. And so it was just, he just came across my name and I got the phone call. And when I got that phone call, I was like, I was so amped. And it's always like, you never know, like that's what's crazy about our business is I'll be home for, I don't know, a couple months. And then all of a sudden I get a phone call, and I've got one where I was working on Mission Impossible 4 and I got a call at 8 a.m. and he goes, "Hey, how soon can you pack your bags and get on a plane?" And I was like 3 hours. He goes, "Okay, great. We're booking your plane ticket right now. Go pack your bags and I'll see you in 12 hours. All right. And that was going to Dubai. I'm like, okay, I'm going to Dubai. And so it's just really random sometimes. So Transformers was actually the same way. I had just had a newborn child, my son Maddox, and he was 3 weeks old when I had to leave, and I was gone. What I was originally told was you'll be gone for 6 weeks, and I go, okay. So I'm leave, you know, for Montreal, and I would think I'm going to be gone for 6 weeks. And when I get to the airport, the stunt guy that's with me, Tom Elliott, he's like, "Hey, this is going to be fun. This is fun. Like, we're going to be out here till December, like till Christmas, man." And it's June, and I'm like, "What are you talking about? Like, I'm gone in 6 weeks." He's like, "What? No, you're not. No, you're here with us the whole time." He goes, "We're not leaving till December." So I'm like, "I got to tell my wife, and my wife's going to kill me." And
boy, that car commercial shoot, it happens within a week, probably seeming pretty good.
It does. It does. The longest one I've ever been on was 3 weeks long. So, yeah. But yeah, I was like, "I got to tell my wife," but I decided to wait the 6 weeks. And then I'm like, "Hey, look, they're going to extend us. Like, I got to stay longer." And that only worked for about 2 months. And then she's like, "Okay, what the hell is going on?"
Yeah, for sure. That's tough. That's tough on family for sure. You know, I've got two kids. Jake's got a son. Yeah, we completely understand.
And I bring them everywhere I go, but this was during the COVID times, and Montreal was pretty wild and crazy about COVID and stuff. So I was like, I didn't want to bring them up there. So
does the stunt coordinator say, "Hey, this is what we're going to do with this 9/11, or do you guys kind of sit in a meeting together and plan the scene, or is it from, I'm imagining the walls full of storyboards with hand-drawn stuff. Like, how are these chase scenes conceived, and what kind of input do you have on, like, dude, that car just can't do that, that kind of stuff?
Another interesting question. I wish that we were more involved as far as the drivers go. I wish we were in storyboards and doing those meetings and setting up which roads we pick and all that stuff, because it's really, we don't get to determine any of it. Like, honestly, on Six Underground, the way that it worked for me was I'd show up to set that morning and I would get in the car of my choice, which there was six alphas there, and they all were a little different. So I would get to pick which car I wanted. If it was cosmetically the same, otherwise I had no choice. And then you get told, "Hey, this is your road. This is what you're doing. Go do it." And you don't get any practice. You don't get any rehearsals. No, nothing. You know, like, it's basically just here it is, and just show me. Go do it.
Is this a budget limitation?
Which is kind of crazy. I mean, like, for instance, like on Transformers and on Six Underground, there was testing, so I did get to test the car. But we were basically dialing the car in, so it wasn't really any like true testing. Like, it was getting it prepared for those things. But it really, like Transformers, it wasn't a lot of testing. It was really just like, get in the car and show me you can do it. You can do it. Okay, great. And then, you know, that was it.
I'm just imagining the head of photography being like, "I need this shot to look like this." And you just going, "Dude, it can't happen." You know, it's these guys aren't drivers. You know,
it happens a lot. But the way I try and handle it is like, I know what they want to see. So, and I know what they want. So I'll tell them, "No, that's not possible. However, I can do this." And I give them another, like, "I can do that." And so then they're not like, oh, okay, like what the hell? Like they at least have, you know, some kind of hope, like, okay, well, we can do this.
Yeah, well, telling somebody there's a problem without offering a solution isn't always the best way to go.
No, it's but you'd be shocked how many times that happens. So so that's usually how I try and handle it. But no, we usually don't get any practice. We don't get to test the roads. We don't get to do anything. It's just get in and do it, which is kind of – sometimes it's pretty hairy, especially when you don't have a lot of practice in the car. But that's why – that's why the coordinators trust, you know, who they trust and bring you on, because you've got the experience. So
that's
were there
sure.
were there any examples of when things did not go well on set that you are there, able to share?
Yeah, there was actually, it's actually on the internet. There was a shot of me in Peru. I was sliding through a corner and it didn't go correctly, and I nosed it into a wall, and that car got damaged pretty good. The reason that happened is it goes into super backstory. So we had five Porsches and we were using them in Montreal to do a lot of the shots. That was majority of the chase was in Montreal. That's where I jumped the car off the flatbed trailer. We were doing, you can't really see it a lot in the movie, but the police chase that we were doing when I did the 180 on the bridge, and I was getting hit by the police car. We did that shot like 6-7 times. And for one, I'm blown away how well the Porsche handled like that amount of damage, because I was getting hit hard. And on the last one, they wanted it to be even harder. And that was like 30 mile an hour difference of him coming in and hitting. And I bent the steering wheel on that one. Like the steering wheel fully bent to the dashboard. So I was getting hit hard, but all these cars, we thrashed all of them, and they needed work done to them before we went to Peru, which we had a 2-week break before we went from Montreal to Peru, and they didn't do anything to the cars. So when they showed up, the car that I was handed was the car that I jumped off of the flatbed trailer, and it was pretty damaged. So they told me to come sliding into the corner with this damaged car, and that's it worked out for the first 6, and then on the 7th one I put it into the wall. And so that was the end of that car for about a week, and then they fixed it up and brought it back. But that was really the only accident that we had on the whole time, and I was pretty bummed out about it, to be honest. Even though we had 4 more cars, it was one of our better ones, and I was not happy about it. I really wanted the cars to be fixed before we went there, but you don't get everything you want. That's why it's like the movie industry is like so glorified, and everything looks so beautiful and everything, but everything is just hidden in this shell of a car. And
so what are you most proud of with this transfer? What's your favorite scene, and walk me through doing it?
Yeah. So I got to say, the scenes up in the Andes mountains where we were drifting through the corners was pretty cool. I mean, it was a little difficult because, you know, going there, I had asked to tune the car so that it would work properly at altitude, because it's 14,000 feet high where we were filming. And that never happened, unfortunately. So I gave them the correct jetting. I gave them everything to put in the car to make it work, but they didn't do it. So they actually had the Porsche factory like mechanics there, and they were doing everything they could to, you know, help out, but they didn't have the jetting and they didn't have all the equipment to make it run properly. So we actually had a Porsche 930 turbo there, and that's what I was supposed to drive on the mountain for all these drifting scenes, because it has more torque and power and all that to keep in the range. And it actually didn't run good at all. It was pretty much just a useless dead weight of a machine up at 14,000 feet. So we ended up using the C2, and it was much less power, but it actually ran like well to an extent. And so I was able to at least do drifting shots with that car, but it was still sputtering, but it was like very, you know, it's difficult when you're that high. The altitude
makes a big difference. Is it a lot of clutch kicking, or how are you getting this thing to come around the corner? There's gotta be no power, man.
No, the clutch kick wouldn't work in that car. It wouldn't work at all unless you were at a standstill. So I had a handbrake in there, and okay. So I would go into the corner and I'd throw the handbrake and, you know, get it into its drift and try and hold it. the most difficult part was that it's rear engine and it kept wanting to, you know, keep going. So what I learned on that was I kept the front tire pressures at 35 and I lowered the rears to like 28, 27. So I had a lower pressure and it helped it to not keep rotating. So that, sure, that pressure change made a big, big, big difference. And that was literally the only thing. The car was stock. It was bone stock. It had stock suspension. It had stock brakes. Everything was stock about that car. The only thing different was the handbrake and the tire pressure was lower in the rear.
All right. I'm going to pull up your Instagram. So I want to grab this, this picture here. I want you to explain to me kind of what's going on in this, in this photo. Cause I'm having a little trouble. Yeah. I'm having a little trouble understanding what I'm going to describe to listeners here is there is a, looks like if you imagine a Kirky race seat shoved in the back. Okay, so it is a Kirky race seat shoved in the back of a 911. This looks like you're about to drive around the rear of a fire truck is what this looks like. It's got a steering wheel and gas pedals behind the driver's seat. Tell me what's going on here.
So in between the wheel there is the switch to turn on the car. So this was actually – there was no engine in this car. It was actually a battery-powered Porsche. So they took a big – battery from a golf cart and threw it in the trunk, and that's what was powering it. So there was, it was all electric. The whole car was electric, which was a bit strange in the first place because it was fast. It was so fast, and we were driving in reverse, and you know the wheelbase is different from front to rear, and it was just weird to drive, especially because I'm driving sideways, completely looking right out the rear window this way. Pedals here.
Is the actor in the front seat? Are you like crouched down so they can film him or what? Like, why are we doing this?
We actually had another stunt guy dressed as the actor to sit in the front seat. And so the actor never actually sat in there. I don't know if they had plans on it, but I was going pretty fast in reverse, you know, going through the cars. And so I don't know if it was like the safest thing ever to do with the actors. So that's why they put the stunt, and they couldn't really see him anyways, you know? So, right. But to be honest, what was the most sketchy about that was the road was, freshly paved, but when they paved it, it was like this, like a wave.
Sure.
So the car would be, it had stock suspension in it at over 100,000 miles and it was blown. They were blown. So I'm going through this, you know, wavy surface and the car is hopping like this. Like while I'm going through cars, it's hopping like. It was so terrifying. It was probably the most terrifying thing I did in the whole film, to be honest with you. So
good grief. Yeah, that looks terrifying. Okay, so what am I looking at here? There's looks like an IMAX camera or something. Obviously, this wasn't filmed in IMAX, but what is this?
So that's the same, the rear drive car there. It's the same seats that I was just talking about. And that camera is facing out the front. So it was basically trying to show the stunt guy's shoulder grabbing the wheel and the shifter. And looking out the front of the car.
Good grief, dude.
And okay. So I would have been driving that one forward. But
And what have we got going on here in this shot? Is this fairly typical?
Yeah, I was actually going for my walkie-talkie because I forgot it. So I know the door's open there, but it was a shorter distance and it just kind of worked out for me. But yeah, that's the C2 that I was driving.
Is this just how you film? Like, this is how you film the drifting shots was with this rig on the car.
Yeah, so they put this rig on the car, and if you can picture it, right where that post is on the right rear tire, they have a camera that would be mounted onto that. And so when the shot that you see in the trailer of the car coming drifting, you know, past the railing on the mountain, that would be from that camera, that angle right there. So
it is. This is all really awesome, dude. I mean, seeing all this stuff. And hearing a little, there's the camera right there. We can see it on the rear of the car right there.
Yep, there it is.
There it is. Cool, man. Let me close this down. All right. So what's next, man? I mean, I don't know. Like, what could you do to top driving a 911 in Transformers? Like, what?
To be honest with you,
what do you want to do?
What I would love, my next goal would be, you know, they're making another Fast and Furious movie. Okay. So, and I know it's like, in parts of another one, but there's a whole nother production team and a whole new director. And it could be, this could like completely change
everything. You need to give me the director's number. You need to give me his number.
Here we go, Brett. Here's my pitch. Just wait, Brett. Just wait.
Here's my pitch. You know how, like, when you had the old Batman movies with Jack Nicholson and stuff, they were all kind of like...
They were really campy, right?
They were campy and kitschy, and they weren't very good. And then all of a sudden, this new Batman comes out. And it's all, like, dark and moody and actually good.
Yeah.
I'm like, the Fast and the Furious movies are not... They're entertaining, I love the stunts. I love everything. Like, I love watching them. They're entertaining. But they're not good. But no, I bet we could have, like... a good Fast and Furious movie. Just imagine, okay, for a second, like a
Christopher Nolan.
Yeah, Christopher Nolan directs Fast and Furious. And it's like a 60-year-old Dom, right? And he's like sitting at with his family, of course. It's all about family. Sitting with his family at the table eating cereal. And the kid, like, his kid is just like, Dad, I want to know what's in the garage. The garage has been locked for like 30 years. Nobody knows what's in the garage. And he's like, Son, You're 16 years old. I think you're finally old enough to know. And he gets up. He's got his wife beater on, and they kind of lumber out to the garage. They open there, and he pulls a sheet off the car. It's the Challenger, I think Challenger, whatever, that had rolled over, and it's there. And they work on the car together for like a common purpose of for some reason. I don't know what the motivation is yet. Oh, I know what it is. Somebody picked on the kid at school, right? They shoved him in his locker, and then they put like some sort of liquid
on the
locker, and he was all covered in like a milkshake, and he had to come home, and his dad's like, oh, why didn't you fight back? He's like, I can't. He's like, I know how we can fight back. And then they have the car, and then they go and they race with these other kids that have like, they have Teslas, right? They're cool. Teslas.
He's the prep guy.
This is like all off the cuff, right? So they've got their Teslas, and they pull up to the light, and the kid at the end of the movie, or towards the end of the movie, pulls up in this Challenger, and he's got to beat this freaking jock, punk, douchebag, pop collar loser with his stupid blonde cheerleader
Is how, like, Tokyo Drift started, by the way, was that same premise that you're explaining. But it was a Viper instead of the Tesla.
I think you're right. Yeah.
Hey, we could. I mean, we just turn the lighting down a little bit.
I like the idea of bringing it back and really moody, right?
But and I think
I don't
you
think
should
that's
drive
the way
the challenge. I don't think. Yes, I think you should do it. I think you should be the
coming full circle. Yeah.
If you think about it, the first Fast and Furious was so good, right? It was an iconic film.
It was very iconic, yeah.
If they just go back to those roots and make a new film, it would be so good. Like, they could make it really good. They just need to get rid of all the unrealistic things, and, you know, and then, I mean, like you said, the stunts that they do are gnarly. They're insane. They do crazy stunts, and then they don't show them in the movie, or it's, like, so CGI'd it looks fake, or it's sad. They need to do real stuff. That's what I liked about, you know, Transformers, it was all real. Six Underground, it was real. So that's what they got to just lean to that. So
I watched a special like edition thing of Blade Runner 2049, which is one of my favorite movies. I just love the cinematography. I love the color. I love the photography in that movie. Everything about it. What I didn't know is that all the scenes and sets, that they're all real. Like all the in Vegas, in like the shipyards, everything. It's all real sets. Like he wanted it to look real, and it was all real. And I'm like, well, that's why that's going to stand the test of time, because it all looked real. I don't feel like some of these Fast and Furious movies in like 20 years, it's going to be like, ooh, I don't know.
That's a really good question, and we can maybe leave it off there, Brett. Do you see a resurgence in practical effects with filmmaking? Like, I feel like we were relying a lot on CGI for a long time. And now it seems like there's a lot of weight put on, like, no, we're actually doing practical effects here.
And to be honest, it's a lot. It's almost every time that happens is it's like got to do with budget. So like, cause CGI is really expensive. I mean, so most of the time, if they don't want CGI, almost every time it's because of budget. But I do agree, like, some movies have been trying to go to, like, realism and stuff, and which I appreciate. But, like, the last movie I was just working on, I was out in Paris, France for quite some time, and they were trying their hardest not to use CGI, but it just wasn't – a lot of the shots weren't working out, like, the way they wanted. And every day, they'd be like, wow, it's okay, we'll just CGI it. And they're just like,
fix it in post, right? Fix it in post.
The ultimate, and even the director was John Woo, and he's, you know, he's a big director, and he was just getting so frustrated because we go watch all of his old movies, and everything is like real, like they did all their stunts real, the killer, hard boiled, like everything is real. So when he sees things and they're like, yeah, no, just CGI, I feel for him. I feel it tears my soul out.
Yeah, I feel like that's the stuff that's going to really stand up as we look at movies, you know, 20, 30 years down the road. You know, especially, I mean, if you look at the cusp of CGI coming into movies, you're like, oh my God, those movies look just dated and terrible. And I think we're at a point now where it's getting tough to tell, but just the way that actors interact in a world when it's real is different. It's almost like you can see the way that they're interacting with something that's actually there, not something that's, you know, put in from a green screen later.
It's kind of interesting, like, I don't know, going back and watching, like, for instance, the Transformers shots of when I come up and slide the car and it transforms into Mirage. I go back and watch those, and it's funny because, you know, it's a CGI transition, but however, they used CGI in the slide as well, which to me, I know they have to transition it, but like the car slides in. And when you slide a car, the front wheels will go out, right? Like the countersteer.
Countersteer.
Well,
yeah.
When you watch it again, wheels don't countersteer; they just stay in. And I like for me, it just it bothers me because I know that I didn't do that, and so they CGI'd the car at the last second. And
the CGI nerd didn't drive enough Gran Turismo is the problem.
It just, you know, but that's like the thing: you'll do real stunts, and then they change things, and it makes it look not as real. If that makes sense, even something small like that, like I can see it and I'm like, so maybe the drivers need to sit in with the CGI portion of it as well.
I can't understand why they wouldn't have you guys
consult, right?
The car, especially in a movie like Transformers, the car is so important. What you're doing in that car and the way that you are acting through the car as a character and a living thing, and especially it turns into Mirage. Okay. So it's obviously a character, but even the car itself and even a lot of movies, it's so important. And it just drives me crazy to think that you guys aren't involved with the process of what's possible, what's not possible, what would be cool. What aren't you thinking of as a director who basically just, I don't know, these guys get kind of, my vision of a director is a guy that smokes a pipe and doesn't really drive cars. He's not a driver. It's so far removed from what you're doing that they just don't.
And here's the main, I would say the main thing. So stunts are involved in the process. So, but it's only the stunt coordinator. So the stunt coordinator will be in the office. The second unit director, they'll be working together to get these things prepared properly. However, the big thing is like most of those guys aren't drivers, or they don't fully understand like how the drive, they understand it, but that's not their world. Like their world is, it could be horses, but they're coordinating this whole movie. Right. So they have to get this dialed. But the problem is that they can't hire someone to come in to dial it in. They just kind of have to get it done. And then when the driver comes in, then we can give our opinion. But at that point, it's almost like too late.
Yeah.
Or we can fix things, but like only minor things because the budget's already there and it's placed and it's done, but we can only, you know, switch things that are, you know, smaller things. So
yeah, you're not soup. You're at the dinner when it gets set down in front of you. You can put a little salt on it, a little pepper, maybe, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. But it's a little strange because like the fight world, like in the movie industry, the fighters they get to go in and they'll get 2 months of training. They get to go design the whole fight. They get to make a previs video of it, and then they film it, and then they get to train the actors. They get to do, you know, whatever they filmed in their previs might end up in the movie, like exactly how they filmed it, if the director likes it. So they're so involved, and it would make way more sense if drivers also were involved to the same extent, because like you said, we could get the car, we could get, you know, a parking lot and cone stuff off and show you. It's all the same. It makes no sense to me, but that's just the way
that's
it works.
How it goes,
maybe
that's how it goes.
Maybe we've proved ourselves so many times that we don't need to do that. We can just show up.
You guys
up
are
and
too
do
good.
It.
You're too good.
Yeah, that's just it.
You're too good. Brett, dude, thank you for hanging out with us today. I really appreciate it, man.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been fun.
Yeah. Take care of yourself and good luck on whatever project is next.
Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it. It's been fun talking to you.
All right. Take care.
Thanks, man.